Okay.
All right. Welcome to Security Guy Radio, securityguytv.com at Infuse 2017, Caesars Palace, Las Vegas, guidance software. I got to remember that because I do a lot of trade shows. What's your name, sir?
My name's Tilly Duthie.
And what's the name of your company?
I'm with BakeAir Health System.
Healthcare sector, and you are a attendee here.
That's correct.
Right? And you're learning NCASE, and mm-hmm. I assume you use NCASE right now.
Yes, I've been using NCASE for several years now.
I bet you haven't been using it since 1996.
No,
that's when I first started using it, back when they could search one sector at a time.
Okay.
And that was amazing, because otherwise you had to use Microsoft Disk Editor to do stuff. That's not even available anymore. You can't even see that anymore.
Yeah, things have gotten a lot easier.
Yeah. Now, we had a guy in here from the building industry, National Builder, and I thought, why would a National Builder need a forensic investigation team? They just started it 3 years ago.
Okay.
Because that industry is not really hot on the list of hackers' lists. But boy, healthcare, oh my gosh. Ransomware, all this kind of stuff. Tell us some of the challenges you guys have in the... What do you do for them, by the way?
Well, I do a little bit of e-discovery and forensics, so okay. It's a mix of both. And and now we're getting more into incident response as well.
Oh, interesting.
So we're trying to stand up a full IR program.
Right.
In fact, we just had a tabletop exercise just recently. We're prepping for one with the executives. And so there's a lot of work that's going into that. And we're opening up some additional FTEs to staff up for the challenge.
Now, what's your background? Is it straight IT?
My background started out with IT audit.
Okay.
And so I did that for many, many years.
Not dissimilar to this. I mean,
yeah. Yeah,
forensic, yeah.
There's overlap between the disciplines for sure. And then from that, I ended up moving into more data analytics. And then as I started to do data analytics, again, in an audit support fashion,
right.
From that, I transitioned over to computer forensics, where I started to do full-blown forensic investigations. And then I also got exposed to e-discovery and so started to do litigation support at that time. So I was wearing several hats and then eventually transitioned completely out of audit into just investigations and litigation support.
Now, do you consider yourself an investigator?
Yes, I think you could say that.
Okay. The reason I ask is because this is used to be the exclusive foray of police officers, former police officers, detectives. That discipline was a physical environment, right? And it has shifted to a cyber environment. Do you find that you look at a attack, or e-discovery might be a little different, right? But maybe you're doing e-discovery on something that happened as far as an attack. Are you looking at those threats as people, ones and zeros, or computers? Because as a cop, I look at it as a guy in the basement of his mother's house screwing around because he doesn't have anything else to do. And I'm trying to figure out that guy or girl, that person, right? And I wonder if IT people look at it more like, well, that's just a bunch of ones and zeros, and we have to stop that ones and zeros from coming after us, right?
Sure. I think in my unique role, again, since I'm doing a lot of corporate investigations, so things that come down from human resources, for example, I do look at the end game as a person.
Yeah.
You know, and
mostly
so,
internal people that you're dealing with?
Yes, insider threats, analytics.
Yeah, all right.
In fact, that's some additional stuff that we're going to be ramping up. You know, more a greater focus on tools that can give us visibility into the insider.
Right.
Because as you and I both know, the wide majority of breaches are facilitated, if you will,
it's all
from
internal.
The inside.
It's all internal. When I was at Fox, I bought a software called CompuTrace. And they call it something else now, but basically it's LoJack for your computer or LoJack for your phone. And I put the software on there, and one of the head guy's laptops got stolen. And I said, we'll get it back. We'll never see that computer again. A year and a half later, it dialed in from Ohio at a computer store. Somebody's trying to sell it. Real Canadian Mounted Police went out, arrested the guy. And it turns out it had been stolen by an employee at a conference and then taken out the back door. So like 85% of all laptops in corporations are stolen by the employees.
Right.
And we focus a lot on the external threats, which is great. We spend $85 billion a year on terrorism, and we should, right? But not enough focus is on the inside. I'm just wondering why you think that is. My impression is it's a cultural thing. We don't want to think our employees are bad. Bad for the culture. What do you think?
I agree with you completely. I think that the shift needs to happen culturally within lots of organizations. The whole mentality of Big Brother is watching me, you know. Although most employees, when they sign up for a company, right there in the disclosures is usually a right to monitor clause.
They say it nowadays, yeah.
And so, you know, they sign off on it. And in our organization, we even have a security banner that clearly states that.
Oh, interesting.
That the moment you log on, you know, anything you do or say is going to be subject to recording.
And they still do it.
And then they still do it, right? So I think, you know, I think that there is definitely a need for cultural education and a shift. Tone at the top plays a big part in it.
You know? I agree. I agree.
You may have a certain part of the organization that's for it, and then another part of the organization that's against it.
Now, we got HIPAA in your organization. How does that play a role in all this stuff? Does it restrict you from doing certain things as far as gathering data or evidence or information?
So far, it hasn't. We have a real good partnership with our compliance folks within our organization. Right. So whenever we need to go after data that's in that space that may contain protected health information, we follow all the right protocols and channels to obtain it in a understandable manner to where we are not violating any privacy.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Now, does it have to go in like a SCIV's not the right word, you know, or because it's not a room, but do you put it actually in some sort of cyber safe box before you allow access for people to view the data if it falls under the HIPAA? Just want to, you know, we get the data. Here's the whole file on this guy. It's a Munchausen by proxy investigation, and somebody's pretending they're sick to run up hospital bills, and the nurse is working with them. And now, you know, to scam the hospital. Now we have the nurse record who's an employee and the patient's record. Both kind of HIPAA, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. So do you get to see that employee data because, you know, you have access, or do you have to say, okay, legal department, I think I know who's did this and what's going on. I want to clear it with you first before we start sending, I guess, HIPAA-protected records to certain people.
Oh, we take great caution when dealing with any matter that involves protected health information. And honestly, we don't even have direct access to those systems.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, okay. He should be on the show because he asked the question better than I do. It's a more direct question, yeah. So you don't have direct access, but, I mean, the information is revealed to you as permitted and needed.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct, should we need that. And then we go through the right channels to obtain that information.
So back in the day, my mother-in-law used to work at St. John's in Santa Monica, and she worked in the records department. Mm-hmm. And people came with subpoenas, and people came in with, you know, requests, and I want to see my file. And, boy, that place was locked down tight on a drum with good old-fashioned physical files. And then she would look at it. It would go through a process, administrator would approve it, and then you picked up your medical record. And, you know, I think they did a pretty good job. So you're in e-discovery. Is what you're doing now that old-fashioned version? Is that what you do now, but in an e-format? You get a request for a subpoena. Listen, we got to find out what happened in these records in this situation, and you're digging into that hard drives or those network systems with NCASE, and you're finding the data. Is that kind of part of what e-discovery is nowadays?
It is. I mean, I like to describe e-discovery as a mile wide and an inch deep, and so as opposed to a mile deep and inch wide. And so, to me, forensics is drilling deeper and deeper, and it was very vertical in nature. E-discovery is horizontal. Typically, yes, we get the request from the attorneys. They're wanting they give us a very, very vague understanding of what they're going after.
Exactly.
And then it's up to us to cast that vague net and bring in all the fish.
Right.
So oftentimes,
for them, they hope it's something they didn't ask for. That's what they hope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of the stuff that we bring in may not be relevant, but that's not our job to really question that. I mean, that's what the attorneys want. We give them what they want, and then oftentimes they do come up with secondary or tertiary requests that give us the ability to cull down the data using various filtering logic or processing techniques.
Now, what do you use to keep track of the evidence? Your evidence log, your chain of custody, chain of evidence. What do you use for that? I mean, here's a flash drive. I picked this up at the gas station. Here's your evidence. Here you go. How do you make sure that data is logged and transferred with a record?
Great question. We have a chain of custody form that we've developed that contains all the necessary items.
It's not digitized, though. It's a paper?
We scan it in at the end of the case,
all right,
and it's filed with the case, but it's not digitized, correct. It's an actual paper record.
I just talked to these guys on the corner over here. We'll go see them after the show. They digitized the whole process.
Okay.
So when you access the record, it goes blink. Okay, I got a log of that, and you can't alter their file. You distributed this file to this person, you can't alter it. That's very cool. So now that's interesting. You say that. because back in the day, that's what how the cops did it. Put the evidence file, we staple the bag together, we put the bag in the evidence room, and guess what? Those bags disappeared. Stuff happened. Oops, I threw away the wrong one. Somebody stole something, whatever. In the digital world, you're not really stealing. Well, I mean, you can steal the digital file, but probably somebody's just going to copy it. They're not going to copy and delete it because you'll never know they're in there. Right. How is that different than the old-fashioned evidence room? I mean, you write down that you handed this digital file to that attorney. It's all cool, but how do we know another copy didn't get distributed somehow? How do you keep track of that?
Yeah, I think the secret lies in, again, control and chain of custody.
Yeah.
For example, when we perform digital acquisitions over the wire, and a vast majority of our collections take place that way.
Oh, okay.
You know, we don't actually go after the actual physical hard drive. We make a forensically sound copy over the wires.
Right. That's right, yeah.
And lock it up, and only a handful of individuals have access to that.
In fact, so back in the day, you had to put hard drive 1 in the yellow box and hard drive B in the yellow box and put the wire and push it. And then it mirrored it, did a mirror image. That can all be done digitally on the net now.
That's correct.
Oh, interesting.
So there's
okay.
not a need to actually haul in the equipment.
Good. Now, what type of cases you guys get? And don't tell me, you know, names or anything like that, obviously. But, I mean, I'm just trying to get my imagination around it.
I'll give you some categories.
Yeah, so categories. Okay,
time
good.
Card fraud, for example.
All right, that's a good one.
And so that's a common problem in any organization.
Sure.
You know, people reporting time that they didn't actually work on.
Yep.
We have employment matters, wrongful termination.
Yeah, harassment stuff, common stuff, yeah.
Right, all the common stuff. And then, of course, productivity type concerns come rolling into us as well.
Oh,
so-and-so
right.
is on Facebook all day.
Oh,
can you forensically prove...
They're on your network.
Right,
yeah.
right. And so there's a mixture of different things. And we may even get legal inquiries from the Department of Justice.
That might be...
Or third-party subpoenas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if they're on your network on Facebook, that might be a HIPAA violation. I mean, what if they're doing FaceTime in the hospitals in the background, there's some patient's room with their medical record on it? I mean, could happen.
That would absolutely qualify as a HIPAA violation.
Interesting. Very interesting.
We've had people take pictures of themselves and submit it to social media without thinking twice.
Selfie at the nurse station.
What's on the whiteboard behind.
Yeah. Now, do you guys participate in any training for that kind of stuff? Any standardization to say, hey, look. Here's what you can't do, you know.
We have a strong internal compliance program. All of our employees are required annually to recertify their knowledge as it relates to the HIPAA space. And in fact, as part of that education, we introduce security training as well, phishing vulnerabilities and things like
that. Come back a little bit on your mic.
And so we are very proactive when it comes to educating our team members with what to do and what not to do as it relates to security practices and privacy practices.
Yeah. So, here's a wild question for you. The Internet of Things. I had a couple people on here the other day talking about, you know, medical devices now that are, you know, they're wireless, they're connected to do healthcare procedures. Nobody ever thought that, you know, that device over there that's wireless might have connectivity to the web, which gives you connectivity to the hospital somehow. In other words, you know, I'm on some ventilator and it's got a wireless connection and somebody hacks in like they did in Mission Impossible and turn something off, right? That's not really your area per se, but have you started, it's a hospital or any hospital is not really yours, but start thinking about these kind of things because, you know, we're all tied together. So you might be doing a forensic on a heart machine one day to find what data was on that somebody came in there and changed the code or changed the dosage of the medicine on that, what do you call those things? The little automatic pain relief things, yeah. Right?
Infusion pumps.
That would be a digital forensic investigation on a device. Have you gone there yet with that?
I think that's the future.
Okay.
It's coming, and it may already be here in some organizations.
Yeah.
Knock on wood, we've been fortunate not to encounter that, but that's part of the challenge. You know, I mean, Internet of Things, as well as maybe we could, in the medical world, we're worried about medical devices. I mean, all these medical devices come pre-installed with NICs, and, you know, they connect to the network, and they talk back to everybody, and so that's a huge vulnerability point.
A ventilator that's on the web, or not the web, on the net, it's not really a hard drive, like you're used to investigating. It's not a position on the network or a hard drive, but it has a chip on it. It's kind of an SSD drive, isn't it, that stores data.
Right.
Would NCASE be able to get into something like that in theory if you put it on the web as a you know, an attachment to your network?
I believe so. I mean, as long as it has, it talks on our network,
yeah,
we should be able to pull back. And I'm excited about some of the stuff at this conference that's been discussed about agentless technology.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we would be very interested in that. Because one of our challenges is with, especially medical devices, the FDA has all sorts of tight, tight regulations as far as upgrading and patching is concerned.
Right.
And even touching that device. So oftentimes, our hands are tied when it comes to medical equipment.
Oh,
we can't go in there and proactively keep it updated, because if we did, we would be in violation of the FDA, and then we would not be allowed to use that anymore.
Well, and heaven forbid you got the wrong setting and something happened. So it's a good rule, but there's got to be a balance between the safety and security. I think it was Mission Impossible where I saw that that episode where, you know, they put a pacemaker in some senator's chest, and then Tom Cruise got in there and connected to the Wi-Fi and gave the guy a heart attack. Or if Tom Cruise didn't do it, he's a good guy. The bad guy did it, right? But
of course.
I thought, you know, when that movie came out, I thought, wow, that's some clever writing, and now that's a reality.
Correct.
Because your doctor can reset your pacemaker from his office and do things like that. And if it's not the doctor on the other end, you got a problem if something happens, right?
Right.
Very fascinating stuff. This has been really interesting. I'm glad you came on the show. I'd like to get perspectives of people that attend the show and see how they're using NCASE and guidance and all that kind of stuff. And I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I did. And excellent interview questions.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on Security Air Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. We're out.